battery on the 26th day of October. It also was mobilized and stationed on Partridge Island, which, as you know, is out in the outer part of St. John Harbor. I was 17 years old at the time of my enlistment and therefore had to have the consent of my parents, which they reluctantly gave. On arrival in Partridge Island, I discovered that anyone under the age of 18 would not be accepted for overseas duty. Therefore, when the time came for my enlistment in the fourth Overseas Siege Battery, I gave my age as 18 and had no trouble about it. Our quarters in Partridge Island were very, very good. They had been used in former years as hospitals for immigrants when they were placed in quarantine before being allowed on the mainland. We were stationed in Partridge Island until late in February or very early March, when we were moved to the immigration sheds in West St. John and took over guard duties on the docks there. We remained at this duty until the 31st of March, when we entrained in St. John for the port of Halifax, from which we were to sail for England. The date of our leaving was not kept secret at all. Therefore, the families and friends of the boys in the battery were able to gather at the Union Station in St. John to say goodbye. And I was very happy to see my father and mother, my sister Mary, and my oldest brother James there at the station, to have a final goodbye with them before the train pulled out. My brother Walter and his wife Rita were also there. We traveled by train to Halifax, arriving in good time in the morning of April the 1st, and immediately went on board the large passenger liner, the Olympic. When the last of the troops were on board, we moved out into the harbor and stayed at anchor there until the 5th. There were six or seven troop ships leaving Halifax that week for England, and as our ship was the fastest one of the group, we were held until the last so that we would all reached the submarine danger zone at approximately the same time, and one naval escort could take us through this zone. We arrived in England on the 11th of April at Liverpool and was soon on the dock side and to the train, which was to take us to Portsmouth. We got away from Liverpool about 7:30 in the evening and arrived in Portsmouth very early the next morning. Our quarters here were in old regular army barracks called Clarence Barracks, and we were in Portsmouth for the rest of April, and on the 5th of May left for the siege training camp outside of Horsham. This was a new They built wooden camp and in a very nice location, about 4 miles from Horsham, which was a very lovely country town. Here we got down to serious training. The men who were to train as plotters and observers were selected there, and the signalers and the men to man the guns and the office personnel. We trained under our own officers. I happened to be one of those selected to train as a plotter and observer, and we got all of our training from our own commanding officer, Major L.W. Barker, who was a very excellent and efficient artillery officer. our training completed, we left for the artillery ranges at Lydd on the south coast on the 27th of June. And there we passed through all our shooting tests very successfully. In fact, at the completion of them, the camp commandant informed Major Barker that our battery had done the best shooting that he had seen on those ranges since the war broke out in August of 1914. On the 20th of July, we left Lydd, and half of the battery went on leave, and the other half proceeded to the city of Bristol, where we loaded our guns on a ship at Avonmouth, which was the outer port of Bristol, also our lorries and all our equipment. When the boys on leave arrived back, the remainder of the battery, which I was included, we left for a few days' leave and returned to Bristol, from where on the 31st of July we took a train for Folkestone by way of London. We arrived at Folkestone on the 31st. I was in error when I said we left Bristol on the 31st. We left Bristol on the 30th of July and arrived in Folkestone on the 31st. Immediately after a short rest of 2 or 3 hours, we went on board ship and landed in Boulogne the same day, 31st of July. It was an extremely hot day, and we had a hard march through the narrow streets of Boulogne, which was a completely uphill job until we reached St. Martin's camp up on a plain back of Boulogne. And there we were under canvas the short time we were in Boulogne, and that was just time enough to get our guns and equipment off the ship when it came in the next day and get them loaded on the train. And on the second day of August, we left Boulogne for, as we called it, up the line. We reached a railhead called Ranceville on the 3rd of August, and immediately we got our guns and equipment unloaded. We proceeded to our first battery position at a place in front of the remains of a village called Maley Maley. It was in an orchard, mixed orchard of apples and pears. And an Australian battery had been there just ahead of us and had been moved because of the constant and heavy shelling it received in that position. As soon as we got into action, a day or two later, we received the same treatment. And the powers that be decided to move us to another position which was better concealed, and we moved to a valley near a place called Engelbeemer, just to the right of a piece of woods called Gad Woods. This valley had a local name of Death Valley, and that was only one of many valleys here and there that we encountered in different parts of the fighting front in France that was called Death Valley by the troops that happened to land in them. There was no suitable place for quarters for us near where the guns were, and we established living quarters in a chalk cliff a mile away from the guns, where we dugouts, and they were nice and dry, and we were quite comfortable there, but it made a long walk for the people on the gun crews and for the plotters and observers when they were serving at the battery commander's post and the signalers, and of course when we took our turn at the observation posts, why then our walks were very much longer and generally in through very exposed positions, or exposed routes, I should say. We were in the angle of the BMAR position approximately 2 months, and then we shifted to a field just slightly in the rear of a ruined village they called Courcelles-Bois. This field had a number of either haystacks or grain stacks scattered through it, and we built imitation stacks over each one of our guns, and it made such perfect camouflage that we were never found during the period we were there. Or if we were, we did get quite a lot of shelling near to us, but none that hit, no shells that hit the guns. They were either between us and the village or on the village or else in a line of reserve trenches that was slightly in rear of our guns. We came off very lucky there and were in that position until around close to the middle of December, when we were pulled out of there and went to the city of Doulons to get on board a train and proceed to another front. The Battle of the Somme of 1916 started before we got there. It started about the 1st of July, and it kept up continuously from then to when we arrived and after and until the time that we, or shortly before, we left the Somme in the middle of December. It was during September that the Canadians moved down to the front just alongside of where we were, and it was there that I first met my brother George and some friends that were in the same unit that he was, who had been in France from September 1915. I also saw another friend, Merton Crawford, from Goshen, and had a pleasant chat with him one Sunday when I was off duty, and did not get a chance to see him again as he was killed the next week on the attack on the Regina Trench, which was one of the sharp engagements during the Battle of the Somme. We had a very busy time in the Somme, and because there was just one battle after another, which was all called the Battle of the Somme 1916, but at the time we called them, I remember there was the attack on the sugar refinery, another one on Thiepval Wood, and then the larger one when Thiepval itself was captured, and the Regina Trench battle, and then the final one that we were in was when the battle at Hebuterne, and shortly after that battle was when we pulled out, and we detrained at a place called Brouet. Our guns had been in constant action from the time we had reached the front on the 4th of August and were in bad need of overhauling. So we had a few days rest in the city of Brouet while the guns were in the workshops getting overhauled. And when they came back to us, why, we moved from there to a gun position in a village called Bully-Grenay, and finally we had the pleasure of joining our own Canadian Corps. Up until this time, we had served with the British Army from the time we reached England, and with our training, and then we came to France, and up until we joined, went into action at Bully Grenade, we were with our own Canadian troops. A few days after we reached Bully Grenade, my transfer to my brother's unit came through, and I joined him at a place called Barlin. We had Christmas in Barlin. The billets for the men at Barlin were among the best that we had all the time I was in France, and the accommodations for the horses, they were undercover. There had been tin, as we call it, was actually galvanized steel roofing, was over them, although there was no sides to the stables, but it made protection from any of the rain storms that came. From there, we moved out to a rest area called Calo Enricor, and both the billets for the men and the accommodations for the horses were very, very poor. In fact, the horses were out in the open. It was the coldest period that I ever experienced in France, and the hills around where we were had snow on them, and the flat field where the horses were tied up, the ground was frozen, and considerable ice was around. This was very hard on them, as when we were in Barlin, orders came down from the powers that be to clip all horses. And here they were clipped. True, they had one blanket, but their bodies and legs clipped, and standing out there in the open on frozen ground, they started to go down in condition, and something that didn't get stopped. Because when we left there, we moved up to a place called Camblinool and started preparations for the Battle of Vimy Ridge, they were very, very hard worked, the men too, and they had pretty muddy standings there. The horses got no opportunity to get back on their feet, as we would say, and their condition continued to go down rapidly right up to and during the Battle of Vimy Ridge. We left the small village of Camblinool and moved to a place called Goshen-le-Gael, where we spent a short time, and then moved to a field alongside of a wood called Bois d'Ilou. It was in the Mont Saint-Éloi vicinity, and here again the horses were in mud and quite deep. Then we moved from there in about 2 weeks' time, as I recall, to a field in front of the village of Mont Saint-Éloi, and just short of a place called Le Target. The first horse I had after joining my brother was called Bunt, and he was a very good dispositioned horse. Nice to ride, although he had a very rough trot, and a very, very fine-looking horse. After the Battle of Vimy Ridge, I got a new one that in the remounts that I named Darkie. He was coal black all over, a little hard to handle until I got acquainted with him, and eventually he became almost a pet, even though he was very high-lifed and had a mind of his own. Made me think a whole lot of a horse I had later in civil life that I called Victor. He was okay as long as you used him, as I used to say, man to man, and that was the same way with Darkie that I had in France. He was a wonderful horse. You couldn't tire him out, or at least I never had him get tired, and I put him through some pretty long hours and rough times. I still had Darkie when I transferred from my brother's unit in 1918 to the 16th Canadian Field Battery, whose hometown was Guelph, Ontario. In the early spring, I was promoted to sergeant, and shortly after that was recommended to recommended for officer's training and to be commissioned in the artillery. During the period I was with the 16th Battery, I was continuously at the guns, and so never had any one particular saddle horse allotted to me. When we moved, I was given a horse, and then when we got into our next position, I was with the guns and didn't need him. So I never even had a chance to get really acquainted with any other army horse after I left Darkie behind me when I transferred to the 16th Battery. I was awaiting word to leave for England to take my officer's training when in the battle near Arras, which was previous to the Canadians reaching the Canal du Nord, I was wounded and left for hospital. I had been very lucky from the time I landed in France. I had been hit and knocked down the very day that I was visiting Merton Crawford. And we had been out in an orchard on the edge of this Boussincourt, the name of the village where they were billeted just previous to going in the trenches for the next push. And we got out there by ourselves to have a little talk when the Germans started shelling pretty heavy, and we hustled out of the orchard and going through a hole in a brick wall for to get shelter behind it when another one broke handier. And I got knocked down but not seriously hurt, whatever. Didn't have wound enough to go to hospital, which I was very thankful for. And I did not even have to go to the dressing station. It was a different story on the 26th of August, 1918, there was no question I was wounded badly enough that I had to be taken to the advanced aid post and then to the field dressing station, where after some bandaging and dope shot into me, I got an ambulance trip down to a railhead at a place called Aubigny, and from there went on a hospital train and landed at the base in France in a British hospital, where I had some operations, and when deemed able, I was shipped across to England to a hospital in London, and remained there until I was ready for a convalescent hospital, and then I was sent to the Canadian Convalescent Hospital just outside of Epsom. I reached there the first week of November, as near as I remember, and anyway, I'd only been there a very short time when the armistice was declared on the 11th of November. A number of us got away from the convalescent hospital earlier than we should have, as we were told that anybody that could get by the doctor, if their unit was going to go into Germany in the Army of Occupation, they could go. That the unit had sent word for their former members to rejoin them if they were able to. So, of course, a number of us who units were going in the Army of Occupation. We talked nice to the doctor, and he let us out. And when we arrived down to the reinforcement depot at Whitley, we found out it was just another one of these stories that no one knew who started them or where they came from. So there was about 25 of us in the group, and we were a disappointed lot and not in very good humor. But anyway, we eventually got... I went to the artillery reinforcement unit, and from there to a camp up at Rhyl in Wales, where the Canadian troops were being gathered together for to proceed home. They were mostly all, like myself, battle casualties, although there was one unit of forestry, and then quite a large number of conscripts who had arrived from Canada, and they were there waiting going back. And we finally got away from Rhyl late in February and sailed from Liverpool for Halifax. It was an uneventful trip back. And I got to Halifax, and from there and trained through to, or supposedly, yes, and trained and went right through to Fredericton, where I was eventually got my discharge on the 4th day of March, 1919. I immediately returned to my home and visited family and friends and around the home area, and my brother and his wife in St. John, Brother Walter, and then my youngest brother Bill went with me to a place called Moore's Mills in Honeydale in Charlotte County for to see my sister Rose and her husband and two children. Then I left with my father for a trip to the USA to visit my two half-sisters, Soretta and her family, in Hartford, Connecticut, and Rachel and her husband in South Deerfield, Massachusetts, returned home. And a few days later, had a job and went to work. I have already named the main battles that we took part in 1916. Well, then in 1917, the Vimy Ridge was the first big action or big battle in April, and it continued, of course. It opened on the 9th of April, and when the main ridge itself was captured, there were still other places in connection with that defense or that German position that had to be captured also, and there was continuous fighting right on through the rest of April and May. And it was on the 23rd of May that my nephew Lee Northrop was killed. He was in the, we went over in the same battery. Also another chap from home, Charlie Boyd, and two of our friends, Cyrus Gaskin from Moncton and Vernon McClaskey from near Woodstock. The four were all killed with the same shell. I got word, or at least my brother George got word of it through a friend of ours from home here, William West, who was in charge of the signalers and brigade headquarters of the brigade that our old battery was in. And he sent word to George, and we went to the place where the boys were being buried. It was called the Cabaret Rouge on the Arras Bethune Road, right alongside of it in the Souchez Valley. And we got there to be present when the boys were buried. My horse got hit in the rump on the way going to the cemetery, but neither George nor I nor George's horse happened to collect any trouble. And the horse was okay. There were four of us who had enlisted in the 4th Siege Battery at the same time from this area. It was Freeman Lewis, and Charlie Boyd, Lee Northrup, and myself. With Charlie and Lee killed, I was the only one left in France of the four, as Freeman Lewis had been gassed and then slightly wounded on his way to the dressing station and was away from the front to hospital at this time. He did not completely recover, but he reached Canada and died in the soldiers' hospital at St. Anne de Bellevue before I arrived home at the end of the war. The summer of 1917 saw the Canadians engaged in a very severe battle we called the Battle of Hill 70. And it, like the Vimy Ridge, carried on for quite a while, but finally ended up in victory and the position well consolidated. And then it was rather just the ordinary trouble from then on until the Canadians were moved to the Ypres country, and the really tough, one of the worst battles that we had to contend with or had to fight was the Battle of Passchendaele, as the mud was so terrible there that it was very, very difficult to carry on. But it finally ended in victory for the British and the colonial troops. The Australians were and New Zealanders were up in that front at the same time. They had a rough time at a battle just before Passchendaele opened up, the Battle of Wycheat Ridge, we called it. But anyway, Passchendaele ended up in victory, and in December we moved away from there, after having been there from late in October. I missed the march to Passchendaele, as I was had left for leave to England about 2 days before the unit moved to Passchendaele. My leave was over. It must have been a little longer than that before they left, because I had my 10 days leave and was back with the unit at Passchendaele the day after they arrived there. And by the way, I was just in time to help Barry, the man, one we thought a lot of. He was quite a lot older than the most of us. We called him Dad, Dad Turner, and he had gone from the unit down to the railhead with me when I went on leave for to bring my horse back to the unit, and I just got back in time to help bury him. Things like that happen so often. We had Christmas after our return from Passchendaele in fairly comfortable quarters. Well, previous to going there for Christmas, we spent a few days on the slopes in front of Mont Saint-Éloi, and there's where we did our voting in the so-called conscription election in December of 1917. And then we moved out to a place called Bovini-Boyeffels, where we had Christmas, and sort of mostly on rest there. And it was there I met a friend from home who was in the 2nd Division, one of the trench mortar brigades, Rupert Perry. He was a lieutenant with them, And that, by the way, was the second time I had seen him since he had arrived in France. From January until the big German attack and breakthrough late in March of 1918, there was just the usual desultory fighting here and there. No one particular battle that I could name, but we sure had a busy time of it when the during that German attack, as the Canadians were used as emergency troops in several places, and we were just preparing to move up to a position on the left of Arras, which was near the front line, when the German attack came on, and all our plans were changed, and we were finally arrived over east of, or on the east of Arras, on what we called the Mametz Front, to back up and, in fact, relieve a Guards division. That's our 2nd Canadian Division, of which our unit was a part. And our division had a rough time for the next 3 months, as we did 93 days straight ahead in the line without relief, or without being out on rest at all, and with constant action all that period. But at the end of that time, things had settled down, and the Germans had been halted and in good shape, and our line was firmly established again. When we got out on rest for a couple of weeks, and then we pulled out for a night march all the way to the Somme, where we had been in 1916. And the reason for the marching at night with the mounted troops was so the Germans wouldn't know we were on the move, and the infantry and all dismounted troops were moved either by train or by bus. The bus is moving by night too. And we just reached our part of the front in time to get our guns in position and our ammunition up when the last battle of the Somme opened on the 8th of August, and it was one wonderful feeling, because it went so good on the Canadian and Australian front right from the start, and the British front. It was such a wonderful feeling to have the Germans out of their trenches and on the retreat in front of us, and out we were in open action and going ahead in grand shape. And it was such a change from the static or trench warfare, as we'd termed it up to then, and it was one wonderful feeling. Eventually, of course, the battle was over, and we left that front and went right back to near the two east of Arras, where we had left a short time before that, and just in time to get our guns in position and our ammunition up, and enter into the when the last battle, or so-called Battle of Arras, well, it covered a much wider front than that, especially to the east of Arras, opened up. And the battle on the 8th of August, it opened up in the Somme, was, and then it was continuous fighting from then till the end of the war. It really marked the beginning of the end for the Germans. And the pressure kept up on them, just one battle after another. Of course, now these next ones I didn't see. The when the Canal du Nord was crossed, or the Hindenburg line was broken, and so on, because I was resting out of harm's reach in hospital when those when the Canal du Nord was fought and the Hindenburg line busted, and from then on I was only a very interested bystander, as it were. While in Partridge Island, we did mostly foot and rifle drill and a lot of the physical training, because the boys from the cities, the same as today, were not in as good physical condition as the boys in the country, and even we needed hardening up, which we got there. On at least two occasions, and I believe it was three, while we were in Partridge Island, we got into the city as a unit. The first time we came over in heavy marching order and took a route march from the city out to Rossi. It was quite difficult as we moved in heavy marching order, and there was a few inches of snow on the roads. There was no snow plowing in those days. But we all arrived in Rossi okay and spent the night in the big school there, and the next morning marched back to the city and on board boats and back to Partridge Island. Another occasion we came over and as a unit, and we marched around the city a bit and then formed up on King Square, on the south side of King Square actually, and had battery pictures taken. Another occasion, I don't believe it was the full battery that came over that time, in answer to an invitation from the congregation of St. David's Church to a church supper and entertainment. And we certainly, those of us that got there, and I was one of them, enjoyed it very much. They put on a very fine supper and were a very friendly, nice group of people. The fact that almost half of our battery was from the city of St. John, or right around it, seemed to work out awfully good for our whole battery, because the city of St. John used us in a wonderful way all the time that we were stationed at Partridge Island and over on the west side. In fact, the city of St. John gave us a grant of money before we left, for which the commanding officer was to have at his disposal to buy things from time to time if they were available for our comfort or convenience, whichever you're mind to call it. We didn't have to spend all this. We still had some of it when we returned to Canada and put it in a special bank account, and it has since financed flowers for different ones, each one that the battery who has passed on since then, and also helped out the odd fellow who ran into hard times financially since the war, and we finally closed it out last year, when we turned the balance of it over to the Ladies Auxiliary of the St. John branch of the Royal Canadian Legion, who have been host to the remaining members of the battery that were able to get to our last three reunions. And the Ladies Auxiliary has served the supper, and we only had four members able to be there at our reunion last September. There were about four or five others that we knew of that either were ill or had illness in the family, or for some other reason wasn't able to get there. We four decided that we would have a dinner together each autumn, or maybe a little earlier in the summer, as long as we were able to get together. Dodge Rankin, Bill Wright, Frank Wilson, and myself were the four who gathered last September. the guard duty on the docks on the west side, which we did through the month of March in 1916, was rather strenuous on us all, as we only had enough men in the battery to form two guards. So we did 24 hours on duty and 24 hours off duty, which meant 24 hours without any sleep and then 24 hours to rest while we were right in the city and friends to see, and with me, relatives, for my brother Walter and his wife lived in the city, and I was a constant caller there when I had the opportunity. But so we didn't avail ourselves of as much rest as we could have. The Canadian Navy at that time consisted of two ships, and one of them, the Niobe, was on this coast, and the Rainbow was on the west coast. And one night, the dock I was on guard, out at the outer end of it, the Niobe was tied up. It appeared that was its usual place to tie up when it was in port. And along somewhere around 1 o'clock in the morning, the commanding officer came along, returning to his ship, and he stopped to speak to me and inquired whether I was cold or not. Well, it was an extremely cold night, and I said, yes, I was. And we were right opposite his ship when we met, so he invited me on board to have a hot lunch. I hesitated a bit, but as the orderly officer of the day and the sergeant of the guard had been around on their inspection a short time ahead of that, I decided I'd take a chance and have a hot cup of tea and a lunch with him, and thanked him and went on board and had a most enjoyable lunch and chat, and got an invitation to avail myself of this any night that I happened to be on duty and his ship was in and tied up at that dock. And he gave the steward instructions that it didn't matter whether he was there or not, why I was to be looked after. I did not have the opportunity of a second visit on board the Niobe. I had a very enjoyable afternoon on one of the CPR passenger ships, as I just happened to be off beat when a group of civilians came along to visit on board this ship, and as they had to go through the dock area and went on the ship, they had to be escorted, and I was sent to escort them with orders to keep them under in view at all times and bring them back when their visit was over. Well, anyway, their visit was long enough that I missed two beats, as we called it, two tours on beat of 2 hours each, and had a very excellent supper and a nice visit with the purser, who put himself out to keep me entertained all the time I was on board. It was rather a coincidence that after I was back from the war and was in St. John in the winter of 1919 and 20, I met two of these officers of the ship on the street, and they recognized me and I recognized them, and resulted in an invitation to go on board ship that evening or any evening when they were in port and have dinner with them. Well, I was free that evening, and I had a most delightful evening with them and a very excellent dinner. And again, I didn't happen to be in town again that winter when the ship was in port. My work kept me out around different parts of the province. It was just a few days at the office in St. John when I was in off a trip. After we arrived in England, we really didn't have very much contact with civilians until we reached the siege training camp just outside of the town of Horsham. And there, We did meet many of them, so we were invited, small groups of us, to different parties, lawn parties or so on, and we were most hospitably received and used. It was wonderful the way these so-called reserved English people could be so hospitable and friendly to such utter strangers as we were. The most of them had a very, very sketchy idea about Canada and about Canadians. And we got some quite weird questions asked us at different entertainments or parties that we were at. I remember one lady that, middle-aged lady, and certainly a well-educated one, and one of the questions that she asked me in all seriousness, or apparently so, was what clothing, if any, do you Canadians wear in the wintertime? And that she had asked me several questions before that were quite in order, but this one surprised me, and to such an extent that I gave her an answer that certainly wasn't anyways near the truth. I told her that when we could get it, why we used animal skins to cover us in the winter and keep us warm. They did a pretty good job. And then she wanted to know about summer, and I told her, well, in the summertime we didn't wear much of anything. In fact, the first suit I'd ever owned was when I after I joined the army. So you see, I didn't always stick to the truth when I got what was I considered to be a rather silly question, and felt that maybe she was trying to pull my leg. In France, we did not get much contact at all with the civilian people, as it was only on the occasional move from one front to another that we were far enough behind the line that we would be meeting civilians at all, and then it would only be where we happened to be camping for the night. My brother George's wife, Jean, was in England, in fact was there months before I arrived in England, and when George came over from leave in the spring of 1916, he came to the camp at Horsham, and Major Barker gave me a few days leave so I could have some time with him while he was on leave from the front, and we had a very pleasant few days together in London and down at Folkestone, where Jean was living at that time. And of course I saw her again when I came over on leave from France in October of 1917. And then in 1918, when I was in hospital in London, she visited me. But before I got out of hospital, Jean had returned to Canada. So when I had my leave on coming out of hospital, when I arrived at the place she had been living, she'd left a week or 10 days previously to go home. I also met my cousin Anna Gamblin from Sussex, who was a nurse in the Canadians, when I was on leave with George, and again when I was on leave in October of 1917. I remember the first words she spoke to me when George introduced me to her down at Folkestone. She was then in a Canadian hospital at, I think they called it Ross Merrick's Hospital, and she just looked at me. I was, I suppose, looked rather young, and she said, "You ought to be spanked." Of course, I didn't agree with her. She was in the Canadian hospital in another part of England when I came over in the fall of 1917 on leave. The name of the hospital for the moment, as I can't recall. Her brother Murray, I met when I came back, came out of hospital and was on my way home. He was at the infantry, 13th Infantry Reserve at Camp Whitley, and I looked him up and made his acquaintance. He was also, his home was in Sussex. He was a brother to Anna that I've just referred to, and their brother Seymour was killed in the Battle of the Somme in 1918. He was a machine gunner with one of our Western battalions, the 44th, I think it was. But on the opening of the battle on the 8th of August, they had put a number of our infantry machine gunners in the tanks, which were being used for the first time on a large scale. And the tank that Seymour was in happened to get a direct hit from a German shell and put out of action, and it burned, and the crew, his own crew, and the machine gunners that had been added to it were all killed. There are many memories that one could record. Some of them are kind of very, very sad, and some are a bit funny. I remember one rather humorous thing in a way, although things were deadly serious at the time. But it was after the German breakthrough in March of 1918, and we were in a rather a hot place, but things had cooled down some, and we were taking shelter and expect to get some sleep in this sort of an old shed affair that had been rigged up for troops at one time, and had some bunks with the chicken wire for mattress. And we just got settled down nicely when the Germans started shelling, and one of the shells hit this shed, and it wounded several of us. I was one of the lucky ones that didn't get hit, and one chap, he started calling out for help. He was hurt bad, and but anyway, we eventually reached him to tie him up, and then we had a real good laugh. We had the other boys all looked after. He was the final one to be checked, and here he wasn't hurt at all, although his face looked very much as if it was all covered with blood. But when we discovered what had happened, there was a can of jam on a little shelf at the foot of his bunk, and quite a piece of shell had hit that can of jam and splattered it, and a big part of it had landed right fair in his face, and it was plum jam. Anyway, it was red. It looked like blood, and when he stuck his hand up to his face after something hit it and saw his hand, he decided that he was wounded in great shape. So we all had quite a laugh at him right there. It's one of those laughs when you're under heavy tension that it just isn't a laugh, but still it annoys. He was quite happy when he discovered that things weren't what he thought they were. A day or two after that, our padre, Captain Shore, a man who was old enough he looked old enough that he shouldn't have been there in the first place, he got quite severely wounded. And we were very sorry to see him go, because he was well-liked throughout the unit. My brother George had a very lovely riding mare he called Dolly. She was Arabian. Her color was what we call strawberry roan, and she had black mane and tail. She was a beautiful mare and very, very easy gaited, and wonderfully smooth to ride. She was deathly scared of any kind of shell fire, or even rifle or machine gun fire. And then, in places where that was happening, you couldn't trust her. Just to what she'd do, and she was capable of some very wicked bucking, and could dislodge most anybody. But I never knew of her trying to Buck George off. He loaned her to an officer one night going out on an ammunition detail, and they come under heavy shell fire, and Dolly lost her head, and she bucked this chap off right by a brick wall, and she broke enough of his bones that he went to hospital, and I don't know whether he ever got back to France again or not. And she was stolen from him in 1916, and about a year later she was found, and he got her back. It was something that he was very, very happy about. He had taken her to France in September 1915, and he still had her when he came out of Germany after being on the Army of Occupation, and was leaving all the horses behind in Belgium before they came back to England and on home. I was happy to learn that Darkie had survived and was still with his unit, and although I didn't think much of him having to end up his days in the hands of the Belgians, because from what I saw of both the Belgians and the French, their treatment of horses, especially their work horses, left a lot to be expected. As I said before,